Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage. Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage. It is day number 21 in the courtroom and the 23rd of February, 2023, the day that Alex Murdaugh takes the stand. Let's go back to the courtroom.
All right, thank you. You may proceed.
Mr. Murdaugh, I want to go to June the 7th, 2021, in your meeting with Gene Seckinger.
Okay.
Do you remember meeting Ms. Seckinger?
I do.
And what was the meeting about?
Jeannie came up to me and asked me, previously Annette Griswold had come to me and asked me about the fee check in the Ferris case. And Jeannie was coming to me and saying that she was following up on that. If she didn't, she wouldn't be doing her job. And asked me some questions.
Well, let me ask you.
Which I understood.
Briefly, the Ferris fee, what originally happened to it? The PMPED portion of the Ferris fee.
I mean, originally?
Yes, sir. Did it come to you directly?
Yes.
Should it have come to you directly?
No.
Okay. Did, when Ms. Seckinger asked you about the, where the fee was, what did you tell her?
I can't remember exactly what I told her. The conversation got interrupted very quickly, but I told Jeannie that the funds were in Chris Wilson's account and nothing to worry about. I didn't know where the mix-up came from.
What was your level of concern about Ms. Seckinger's inquiry to you on June the 7th?
There was some level of concern because she's asking me about money that I took that I wasn't supposed to have. So certainly I had some level of concern, but it wasn't a very big concern. As you heard testimony earlier, at some point Annette Griswold had sent Chris Wilson an email, something to the effect of, Alec thinks he has more expenses or something like that, seeking financial documents from Chris Wilson. When Chris Wilson got, I wasn't copied on that, but when Chris Wilson got that, Chris Wilson called me up and he's like, you know, what is this all about?
Pardon?
I said objection, rule Zeta 1 and 802.
Response?
Your Honor, I'm not asking for what Chris Wilson said, and I'll move on.
All right.
I accept the objection. Were you concerned about Chris Wilson opening his trust account records to your law firm?
No, I was not concerned about that at all.
And why were you not concerned?
I knew that one of the people that Chris Wilson, as you heard, Chris Wilson and I were very close. We talked every day. I did work with him all the time. And, I mean, he was one of the people closest to me in the whole world. I knew everything about him. And I knew he was going through one of his partners, and he and his partner had split up. A partner and an associate had moved to a firm in Charleston. The partner was going through a divorce, and the wife of the partner was trying to get Chris Wilson's trust documents in that case to find out money her husband got. It didn't have anything to do with Chris and I or anything. It totally had to do with that. But I knew that Chris Wilson was not going to send any financial documents to my law firm, at least at that time, and at least not anytime soon. So while I'm sure it registered with me that I got to deal with this, at that particular time, it wasn't anything that was a big deal.
Was there an immediate urgency to the situation on June the 7th?
No.
And I believe there's Ms. Seconder testified about your conversation with her. You learned that your dad was going back in the hospital.
That's correct. There was a text. I can't remember if that text came from my brother Randy or my brother John, but they were the ones that were taking my dad back to the hospital that day. And whichever one was with him, I believe it was John was with him at the hospital, but I know Randy was with him at some treatments. It's in those documents. But bottom line is, we got a text saying, we knew my dad was really sick. He had cancer, and he couldn't breathe. And there was a big issue about whether his inability to breathe was coming from an obstruction caused by the cancer, which was the worst-case scenario, and that's what it ended up being ultimately. And that's what he died from. But this particular text was saying, okay, we're putting him back in the hospital. The doctor thinks it's pneumonia, and which was, you know, I mean, pneumonia is never a good thing, but when compared to cancer, at that time, pneumonia, that was a good thing to learn that.
So on the 7th, were the information you had, were you believed at that time that the prognosis was pretty positive for your father?
Well, it was better than the alternative. I'm not going to say it was good, but it was better than the alternative and what we had previously thought it was. It didn't stay good very long, but it definitely was better.
Do you know whether or not you told Ms. Seconder that that your dad's condition was terminal on the 7th. Do you remember whether you said that or not?
No, I wouldn't have said that at that time. And what I, you know, Jeannie, as soon as the thing comes through that my dad's going in the hospital, Jeannie and I, as you heard, I mean, she stopped the meeting. We stopped it. It lasted a couple minutes. Now, my dad's going in the hospital, and the very next day, we learned that he's terminal, and I'm just sure that a year or the amount of time that's gone by, Jeannie assumed she was terminal. He was terminal.
Speculation, Your Honor.
Objection's overruled.
Mr. Murdick, on June the 7th, did you believe that your financial house of cards was about to crumble?
On June the 7th?
Yes, sir.
Absolutely not.
Had you had, and I think there's documented evidence, state introduced, had you had reached out to Russell Lafitte at Palmetto State Bank about extending a line of credit on the Moselle property?
Yeah, I had reached out to him. I can't remember the date of that text, but it was fairly recently. I had reached out to Russell.
And on June 7th, did you have equity in the Moselle property that, or you and Maggie had equity in that Moselle property?
Sure. And I mean, Moselle was fully in Maggie's name.
Okay.
But yes, there was equity in Moselle. In looking at the documents that had been used, there was $1,800,000 owed. There was an appraisal for $3.3 million without timber value. And so on 1,700 acres, you know, I don't know what the timber value was, but if you just set $1,000 an acre, that'd be another million-something dollars in value over and above the appraisal. I doubt the timber value was that high. I'm just using that as an example. But if it was 500, it'd be another $800,000. So, you know, there was several million dollars in equity in that Moselle property.
All right. And did you have equity in the Edisto Beach House?
Yes.
And on around June 7, how much equity did you have in the Edisto Beach House?
If I remember the records correctly, there was about $250,000 owed on that house and whatever the value was at the time. I think there's a contract for just under $1 million, so $700,000+.
Did Maggie's death make it more difficult to obtain financing immediately after the murder around June 7th, 8th?
Maggie's, yes.
How so?
Because the entire Moselle property was 100% in Maggie's name. The Edisto property was 50% in Maggie's name. So I was only a half owner. So with Maggie, all I had to do was get her to sign the documents, which she always did. I mean, she didn't question finances. So, I mean, she signed the papers. When Maggie wasn't here, there was estate issues. I couldn't go and sign the papers like I would normally go and get a loan. So I couldn't.
Okay. Was there a hearing scheduled in the boating lawsuit where you were a defendant set for that week?
Yes.
Do you remember what day it was scheduled for?
Well, I mean, I've heard the testimony, and I knew, I'm sure I knew at the time it was June the 10th, Thursday, June the 10th.
Right. What was your level of concern about that hearing coming up on June the 10th?
About that hearing?
Yes, sir.
My level of concern about that hearing was about the venue motion that was coming up, which
Now, what do you mean by venue?
A venue motion is, venue is where a civil lawsuit is pending. And so there's laws and rules that govern where you can bring a case. There's laws and rules that govern how certain parties, a defendant or a plaintiff, can go about trying to move it from one place to another. So in this case, the plaintiffs, the Beach family, had filed suit in Hampton County. Parker's was trying to move venue to Beaufort County. And I wanted the case to stay in Hampton County. Really, that was my only thought about. I wasn't doing the legal work on those. I was a party in that case. I wasn't. I mean, Danny Henderson was primarily representing me personally. John Tiller and Amy Bauer were representing me personally. And Dawes Cook was representing me personally. And those are the guys that were doing the legal work. So, you know, I wasn't actually doing that work, but what I was concerned about was the venue motion. I had already done what I had to do for the financial motion, and Danny Henderson was on me about getting him a financial statement because...
Let's stop. So, okay. There was a motion to compel and seek a lot of financial records from you. Was that correct?
Absolutely.
And were you concerned that your house, financial house, was going to be opened up for the world as a result of that hearing?
No. I've been a plaintiff's lawyer, like Mr. Tinsley that sat here. We do the same exact thing. In my law firm, the guys in my law firm are some of the best lawyers that I've ever known. And they're definitely some of the best lawyers in the state, handling some of the biggest cases that have ever gone on in this state. In my 27 years of practicing, plaintiffs always are trying to look and get financial documents of corporate defendants, of, you know, those type things. In my 27 years, I've never been able to get a judge to order anything more than a net worth statement prior to getting into a phase at trial. So early on in the case, I am not aware of, I personally have never, despite trying repeatedly, have never been able to get a judge to order the kind of information that Mark Tinsley was saying he was seeking.
Were you working on a document for that upcoming hearing?
Yes.
And what was that?
A financial statement. A financial statement lists your assets and your liabilities.
And had you reached out to Jeannie Seckinger later that the day on the 7th to get your current balance of your retirement account?
You know, I don't remember doing that, but that'd certainly be something that I did, and because I know I'd have to have that for that financial statement. And the document that I prepared was what Mark Ball talked about that he found later in my office. And it was tight. It was handwritten, ready to be typed up by, you know, because of the charges against Paul, I kept everything very close in the civil case. It was Danny in his office. It was doing it. And I had that document prepared, handwritten in the neatest handwriting that I could make, because a secretary other than mine, a paralegal other than mine, was going to be the person who was going to put that financial information into the final document. And that's the document that Mark Ball talked about that he found on my desk whenever it was that he found it. Okay. So that was what was going to be, if necessary, what was going to be used Thursday.
Alex, the jury's heard about testimony of you stealing client funds. Did you do that?
I did.
Did you steal or divert that Ferris fee away from the law firm?
I did.
How did you get in such a financial predicament that led you to steal money that wasn't yours?
No, I'm not quite sure how I let myself get where I got, but it came from, you know, I battled that addiction for so many years. I was spending so much money on pills. I got in a spot I couldn't.
Now, what type of addiction are you referring to?
My addiction is to opiate painkillers.
And when
specifically oxycodone, OxyContin.
And when did you first become dependent or addicted to opioids?
Oxycodone or opiates in general?
Opiates in general.
I'm not quite sure of the exact date, but I can give you a time frame. I hurt my knee really bad playing football in college, and I had a knee surgery. And The medical science at the time was such that the surgery didn't work, bottom line. So it just didn't last. So within a couple of years of that, I started having a lot of knee troubles. And ultimately, I had to have a couple of surgeries. But the last surgery I had was, I think, around 2002 or 2004. and I think it was around 4, so I would have started taking hydrocodone a couple of years before that. And I took hydrocodone, got addicted to that very quickly. I continued taking that for a long time. I'd force myself off of it, wean myself off of it. I'd go back to it. I battled that for a long time. And after a while, I was taking so much of that, I moved on to oxycodone. And, you know, I'm guessing that was around 2000, that transition was around 2008, 9, something like that. And of course, you know, it just escalates.
Did you receive treatment or go to detox on occasion?
I did.
How many times?
That I went to detox or that I detoxed?
Well, let's start with going to a detox facility.
I've been to a detox facility 3 times.
When was the first time?
December of 2017.
Okay. And before December 2017, had you tried to detox at home?
I tried to detox everywhere I could.
When
Maggie would help me. Go ahead.
Yeah, when you went in to a, was it inpatient facility?
The detoxes, the formal detoxes that I went to?
In December 2017.
Yes, it was it was inpatient. And all 3 formal detoxes that I've done have been at the same facility called Sunrise Detox in Atlanta, Georgia.
And it's
very good facility.
Jury's heard an audio tape of a telephone conference with SLED agents. Was that where you were during that meeting with Mr. Harpootlian and I?
That's correct.
The first time you went to the detox in Atlanta, how long of a stay is that? Did you stay?
7 days is the opiate detox program.
And is there a difference between detox and rehab?
Yes.
What's the difference?
Detox is the act of getting the drugs out of your system, getting to the point where, okay, there is no longer a physical dependency, all right? And that's a big difference than the rest of the dependency, but the physical dependency is supposed to be gone after 7 days. So, in other words, there are so many things. Opiate withdrawal is hard. But supposedly at the end of 7 days, you don't have those physical symptoms. Like, I don't want to be too graphic, but you're sick, you throw up, you have terrible diarrhea, you sweat like you're running a marathon, you can't hold your legs still, you can't lay down. Now, like, what I'm talking about, the legs moving, that goes away after about 24 hours. So, you know, after about 24 hours, you can lay down again and maybe sleep some, but you sweat, you throw up, there's so many issues, but after 7 days, those are supposed to be over. That's what detox is, the detoxification of your body.
And what's rehab?
Rehab is the period that you go to learn how to stay off. You know, you supposedly off after detox. Rehab is where you get help staying off.
And before September 2021, had you ever gone to that second stage of rehab?
No.
So in December 2017, how long did it take you to relapse once you got home from detox?
Not long at all. I mean, you're still going through. And though this physical dependency is gone, you're still so sick. I mean,
Is that something you been battling for quite some time?
As long as I can remember.
How long have you been drug-free, opioid-free?
535 days, and I'm very proud of that.
I want to ask you questions about Labor Day weekend 2021.
Okay.
Do you remember being confronted by your law firm?
Sure, I do.
And what were you confronted about?
Stealing money.
And did you admit your misconduct to your law partners?
Well, to one of my law partners and my brother and my law partners, Danny and Randy.
And they learned about a fake forge account. Did you admit to the fake forge account?
Yes, I did.
And did you tell them about your opioid struggles, opioid addiction?
I told them about my addiction, yes, sir.
To your knowledge, were any of your law partners aware of your addiction?
Not just to my knowledge. I'm certain that they were not aware of my addiction.
How would you characterize your opioid use or addiction? Severe, moderate?
Then or now?
No, in 2020, 2021?
I don't know how I would have characterized it then. After going to rehab and learning more of the things I've learned, really talking to addicts about experiences, I will tell you that my addiction was extremely, extremely bad.
How were you able to function? Or were you able to function?
Yes, I was able to function.
You were able to practice law?
Yes.
And were you successful practicing law while you were addicted to opioids?
On some level, yes, sir, I was successful.
After you were confronted on Labor Day weekend 2021, did you resign or were you forced to resign from a law firm?
Absolutely.
And then on Saturday, September the 4th, do you remember what happened that day?
Saturday, September 4th, yes, sir, I remember.
And what happened?
Start when I woke up.
Well, let's start after you met with Chris Wilson. Did you meet with Chris Wilson?
I met with Chris Wilson at my mom's and dad's house in Alameda.
And did you lay it out for Chris Wilson, your opioid addiction and your misconduct?
I definitely laid out my addiction. I definitely gave him some details about monies that I had taken. We didn't go into all the details about all of it, but I certainly was very candid with him about the things that involved him.
Had you already just contacted the detox facility before you met with Chris Wilson on the 4th?
I believe that we had already, at that point, I believe that we had already spoken to the guy that I knew from Sunrise and made arrangements for me to go there on Monday.
Okay. And
I know we had arrangements for me to go there on Monday, and I'm sure we had to have had it by then because I went to the hospital shortly after that. So, yes.
And did you reach out to Blanca to get your insurance information?
I did.
And for what purpose?
Because I was going to use my insurance at detox and rehab to help pay for it.
And what was your immediate plans after mean, for the day after you met with Chris Wilson, did you have plans to do anything, have any other meetings on that Saturday?
I wanted to go and meet with Corey Fleming, who was another lawyer who was affected by the things I did.
Okay. And did you?
And a good friend.
Did you go meet with Corey Fleming?
No.
What'd you do instead?
I'd given my, when I gave my pills to my brother Randy and Danny, I think I gave them to Randy, but I took a lot of pills because I knew I wasn't going to be taking anymore. So Randy had my pills. I had to get some from him the night before, but I only got a small amount. I could tell, you know, I wasn't taking anything near like what I had been taking, so I knew it was coming. And I called someone to bring me more pills. And before I met with Chris Wilson.
And did you meet this? Did the person you called bring you more pills?
You know, I don't know if he brought me more pills or not, because by the time I met with him, after meeting with Chris, and after, you know, the starting of the withdrawals, I changed my plans.
And what was the change in plans?
Not to get pills from him anymore. And instead, I asked him to shoot me.
Did you ask him to shoot you as a sympathy ploy? Or did you want
as a sympathy ploy?
Yes, sir. Why did you ask him to shoot you? What was the end goal in your that you wanted to accomplish?
I meant for him to shoot me so I'd be gone.
And who was this? Who did you ask to do this?
Eddie Smith.
And did he in fact shoot you?
He did.
And where was that located? Not your gun shot, but where were you shot in Hampton or Colleton County? Where were you?
It's Hampton County. It's right on the border of Suckahatchee Road. It runs right along the Suckahatchee River.
And why did you want to be gone?
I mean, I knew all this was coming to a head. I knew how humiliating it was going to be for my son. I mean, I'd been through so much. At the time, in the bad place that I was, it seemed like the better thing to do. I don't think that way now, thankfully, but
right.
I did at the time.
Did you have life insurance on you?
Oh, yeah, I had a lot of life insurance.
And who was the beneficiary?
Maggie was the beneficiary.
How much life insurance did you have?
I had $12 million. I had a $4 million policy and a $12 million, and an $8 million policy, a total of 12.
Did you ever have any life insurance on Maggie?
No, never.
Did you ever have any life insurance on Paul?
No.
Alex, will you tell this jury about Maggie and your relationship with her?
Y'all saw a picture. She was just as beautiful inside as she was outside. And she was so adventurous. I mean, you couldn't tell her something was good or bad. I mean, she wanted to find out for herself. She wanted to do it, see it, experience it on her own and form her own opinion. She was devoted. Those two boys, Buster, Paul, me. I mean, she made sure we didn't want for anything ever. Fun, playful. I mean, she had a laugh that, you know, you didn't even have to know what was funny. If you heard her laugh, you would laugh. You know, she had this little playful look where she'd smile at you and bite her lip. I can't do it, but I mean, when she'd just do it, it'd just melt you. You know, she was such a lady, such a feminine person, a girl, but then she had two boys, and I mean, she didn't grow up in the swamp and in the country, riding four-wheelers and hunting and fishing. And I mean, she changed everything. She became a boy's mom. I mean, her life became ball and riding four-wheelers and, I mean, doing those things. Now, don't get me wrong, she was still 100% girl. And you heard Marion say, I mean, she loved to do those things with her nieces, but, I mean, she threw herself into her boy's life. I mean, you know, she never took not working for granted. I mean, she might not have worked, but I promise you, she worked. And she worked to make sure me and Paul and Buster had everything. You know, she wanted a big family, and pregnancy just didn't suit her. I mean, her pregnancies were so hard. I would leave her in the mornings and she'd be sick. I'd come home and check on her and she'd be sick. I'd come back at the end of the day and she'd be sick. I mean, she was so sick all the time with both those boys. And when we had Pawpaw, Maggie got in trouble and Pawpaw got in trouble. And just pregnancy didn't suit her. So we decided that, you know, we would just have the two boys. And you know, I just think how hard it was on her. Just made her love those boys so much more. And she did. But she was the kind of person, Maggie, you know, she could put on the most elegant ball gown and go to the governor's mansion and hang out with, you know, the most affluent people, whatever. Or she could come down to, you know, she could go to a food bank in Hampton or Walterboro and fit in. Everybody at both places would say when she left, and that Maggie, she's a good one. She's just a special person.
Alan,
very special person.
Would you ever do anything to harm Maggie?
I would never hurt Maggie. Ever.
Will you tell the jury about Paul, please? And your relationship with him.
And Paul. I mean, Paul was just the brightest. He's the most inquisitive young man. He wanted to be a part of everything. If you were working, I can remember as a little boy, you'd be working on something. It didn't matter what it was. His little head was going to come in there, his nose in there to see what you were doing. He was a man's man. He was a 100% country boy. He was tough. I mean, he could hunt anything. He could catch any fish. He could run any piece of equipment. He could use any tool. I mean, he could do anything. At 22 years old, he could do so many things. I mean, he took care of so many, and he was so tough. But on the other hand, he had a side to him that was just so sweet. I mean, he wouldn't come home, where he wouldn't go check on his grandparents. He wouldn't go near Somerville, where he wouldn't go out of his way check on his grandparents. You know, to be such a tough person, he would get all of his buddies and get on a boat and go watch a sunset. I mean, 22-year-old people, you know, do stuff like that. I mean, he was such a special boy. He cared about people. He was fiercely, fiercely loyal. He was so misrepresented in the media. I mean, never, never an accurate story told about what he was. And I'll challenge you right now. I will challenge everybody in this room to go find somebody that knew Pawpaw, who really knew him, that did not have an ulterior motive, that would say something negative about him. And I challenge everybody who can hear me now to do that. I mean, Paul was that kind of person. If you knew him, he would help you. And he would be glad to help you. You know, I thought Mark Ball made a good point when he said, you know, Paul might not have quite found his place yet. Paul was ADD, ADHD, and so he would jump around from thing to thing a lot. But there's absolutely no question in my mind whatsoever that Paul would have found whatever that thing was that he was going to do. And whatever that ended up being, he was going to be one of the best at it that you've ever known. And I'll tell you one more thing. I didn't even know this when Paul was alive. But, excuse me. When they were doing his eulogy, I gave the names of some of his friends. And he had a real cute friend that they were just friends, but a cute little girl that Maggie adored. I didn't know her very well, but Maggie did. Maggie adored her, but they talked to her. And Pawpaw, we learned this from her, Julianne. And at 22 years old, Pawpaw would tell his friends, be present. appreciate where you are, the things you have, and the people around you. I think a lot of that came from it hurt Paul so bad when Mallory died. But I mean, 22-year-olds, do you know that think that way? Be present. Appreciate things around you. At 22 years old.
Alec,
he's the most special boy.
Do you love Paul?
Did I love him? Like no other. He and Buster.
Do you love Maggie?
Oh, more than anything. I love Maggie from the first time we went out.
Did you kill Maggie?
No, I did not kill Maggie. I did not kill Paul. I would never hurt Maggie, and I would never hurt Paul, ever, under any circumstances.
Thank you. Please answer any questions they may have.
Sir. Thank you.
Gentlemen, we'll take a... We'll take a 10-minute recess. Please do not discuss the case.
That wraps up segment number 4 in our continuing coverage of the trial of Alec Murdaugh. There is more to come. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.